You'll see a driveway on the left. Take it to the back and kill the engine. Have the money ready for me. I understood immediately why the kidnapper had picked this spot. There was only one way in. The stores were all for rent except for the baby crib place. That was on the far right. In other words, it was self-contained and directly off a highway. There was no way anyone could come around back or even slow down without being noticed. I hope the feds understood that. When I reached the back of the building, I saw a man standing by a van. He wore a red and black flannel shirt with black jeans, dark sunglasses, and a Yankee baseball cap. I tried to find something distinct, but the word that came to mind was average. Average height, average build. The only thing was his nose. Even from this distance, I could see it was misshapen, like an ex-boxer's. But was that real, or some kind of disguise? I didn't know. I checked out the van. There was a sign for B&T Electricians of Ridgewood, New Jersey. No phone number or address. The license plate was from New Jersey. I memorized it. The man raised a cell phone to his lips walkie-talkie style, and I heard the mechanical voice say, "I'm going to approach. Pass the money through the window. Do not get out of the car. Do not say a word to me. When we're safely away with the money, I'll call and tell you where to pick up your daughter." The man in red flannel and black jeans lowered the phone and approached. His shirt was untucked. Did he have a gun? I couldn't tell. And even if he did, what could I do about it now? I hit the button to open the windows. They didn't budge. The key needed to be turned. The man was getting closer. The Yankee cap was pulled down until the brim touched the sunglasses. I reached for the key and gave it a tiny twist. The lights on the dashboard sprung to life. I pressed the button again. The window slid down. Again, I tried to find something about the man that was distinct. His walk was slightly off balance, as though maybe he'd had a drink or two, but he didn't look nervous. His face was unshaven and patchy. His hands were dirty. His black jeans were ripped in the right knee. His sneakers, canvas high tops from Converse, had seen better days. When the man was only 2 steps from the car, I pushed the bag up to the window and braced myself. I held my breath. Without breaking stride, the man took the money and swirled toward the van. He hurried his step now. The van's back doors opened and he leapt in, the door immediately closing behind him. It was as if the van had swallowed him, whole. The driver gunned the engine. The van sped off, and now, for the first time, I realized that there was a back entrance onto a side road. The van shot down it and was gone. I was alone. I stayed where I was and waited for the cell phone to ring. My heart pounded. My shirt was drenched in sweat. No other car traveled back here. The pavement was cracked. Cardboard boxes jutted out of the garbage dumpster. Broken bottles littered the ground. My eyes stared hard at the ground, trying to make out the words on faded beer labels. 15 minutes passed. I kept picturing my reunion with my daughter, how I would find her and pick her up and cradle her and hush her with gentle sounds. The cell phone. The cell phone was supposed to ring. That was part of what I was picturing. The phone ringing, the robotic voice giving me instruction. Those were parts 1 and 2. Why wasn't the damn phone cooperating? A Buick LeSabre pulled into the lot, keeping a decent distance away from me. I did not recognize the driver, but Tickner was in the passenger seat. Our eyes met. I tried to read something in his expression, but he was still pure stoic. I stared now at the cell phone, not daring to look away. The tick, tick was back, this time slow and thudding. 10 more minutes passed before the phone grudgingly issued its tinny song. I had it to my ear before the sound had a chance to travel. "Hello," I said. Nothing. Tickner watched me closely. He gave me a slight nod, though I had no idea why. His driver still had both hands on the wheel at 10 and 2 o'clock. "Hello," I tried again. The robotic voice said, "I warned you about contacting the cops." Ice flooded my veins. No second chance. And then the phone went dead. Chapter 6. There was no escape. I longed for the numb. I longed for the comatose state of the hospital. I longed for that IV bag and the free flow of anesthetics. My skin had been torn off. My nerve endings were exposed now. I could feel everything. Fear and helplessness overwhelmed me. The fear locked me in a room, while the helplessness, the awful knowing that I had blown it and could do nothing to alleviate my child's pain, wrapped me in a straitjacket and turned out the lights. I may very well have been losing my mind. Days passed in a syrupy haze. Most of the time I sat by the phone. By several phones, actually. My home phone, my cell phone, and the kidnapper's cell phone. I bought a charger for the kidnapper's cell so I could keep it working. I stayed on a couch. The phones sat on my right. I tried to look away, to watch television even, because I remembered that old saying about a watched kettle never boiling. I still stole glances at those damn phones, fearing that they might somehow flee, willing them to ring. I tried to mine that supernatural father-daughter connection again, the one that had insisted earlier that Tara was still alive. The pulse was still there, I thought, or at least made myself believe, beating faintly, the connection now tenuous at best. No second chance. To add to my guilt, I had dreamt last night of a woman other than Monica. My old love, Rachel. It was one of those time and reality warp dreams, the ones where the world is totally alien and even contradictory, and yet you don't question any of it. Rachel and I were together. We had never broken up, yet we had been apart all these years. I was still 34, but she hadn't aged since the day she left me. Tara was still my daughter in the dream. She had, in fact, never been kidnapped, but somehow she was also Rachel's, though Rachel wasn't the mother. You've probably had dreams like this. Nothing really makes sense, but you don't challenge what you see. When I woke up, the dream faded into smoke, the way dreams always do. I was left with an aftertaste and a longing that pulled with unexpected force. My mother hung around too much. She had just plopped another tray of food in front of me. I ignored it, and for the millionth time, Mom repeated her mantra, "You have to keep up your strength for Tara." "Right, Mom. Strength is the key here. Maybe if I do enough bench presses, that'll bring her back." Mom shook her head, refusing to rise to the bait. It was a cruel thing to say. She was hurting, too. Her granddaughter was missing, and her son was in horrific shape. I watched her sigh and head back to the kitchen. I didn't apologize. Tickner and Regan visited frequently. They reminded me of Shakespeare's Sound and Fury signifying nothing. They told me about all the technological wonders that were being utilized in the quest to find Tara. Stuff involving DNA and latent prints and security cameras and airports and toll booths and train stations and tracers and surveillance and labs. They trotted out the tried and true cop cliches like no stone unturned and every possible avenue. I nodded at them. They had me look at mug shots, but the bag man in flannel was not in any of the books. We ran a trace on B&T electricians, Regan told me that first night. The company exists, but they use magnetic signs, the kind you can just peel off a truck. Someone stole one 2 months ago. They never thought it was worth reporting. What about the license plate? I asked. The number you gave us doesn't exist. How can that be? They used two old license plates, Regan explained. See, what they do is they cut the license plates in half and then they weld the left half of one with the right half of the other. I just stared at him. There is something of a bright side to that, Regan added. Oh? It means we're dealing with professionals. They knew that if you contacted us, we'd be set up at the mall. They found a drop spot that we couldn't get to without being seen. They have us tracking down useless leads with a fake sign and welded license plates. Like I said, they're pros. And that's good because pros usually aren't bloodthirsty. So what are they doing? Our theory, Regan said, is that they're softening you up so they can ask for more money. Softening me up. It was working. My father-in-law called after the ransom fiasco. I could hear the disappointment in Edgar's voice. I don't want to sound unkind here. Edgar was the one who provided the money and made it clear he would do so again. But the disappointment sounded more aimed at me, at the fact that I had not taken his advice about not contacting the police, than at the final outcome. Of course, he was right about that. I had messed up big time. I tried to participate in the investigation, but the police were far from encouraging. In the movies, the authorities cooperate and share information with the victim. I naturally asked Tickner and Regan a lot of questions about the case. They didn't answer. They never discussed specifics with me. They treated my interrogatories with near disdain. I wanted to know, for example, more about how my wife was found, about why she'd been naked. They stonewalled. Lenny was at the house a lot. He had trouble meeting my eye because he, too, blamed himself for encouraging me to come forward. The faces of Regan and Tickner fluctuated between guilt because everything had gone so wrong, and guilt of another kind, like maybe I, the grieving husband and father, had been behind this from the get-go. They wanted to know about my shaky marriage to Monica. They wanted to know about my missing gun. It was exactly as Lenny had predicted. The more time passed, the more the authorities aimed their sights on the only available suspect. Yours truly. After we hit the 1 week mark, the police and FBI presence started fading. Tickner and Regan no longer came by very much. They checked their watches more often. They excused themselves for phone calls involving other cases. I understood that, of course. There had been no new leads. Things were quieting down. Part of me welcomed the respite. And then, on the 9th day, everything changed. At 10 o'clock, I began to get undressed and ready for bed. I was alone. I love my family and friends, but they began to realize that I needed some time by myself. They had all left before dinner. I ordered delivery from Hunan Garden and, per Mom's earlier instructions, ate for strength. I looked at the bedside alarm clock. That's how I knew that the time was exactly 10:18 p.m. I glanced at the window, just a casual land sweep. In the dark, I almost missed it. Nothing consciously registered anyway, but something snagged my gaze. I stopped and looked again. There, standing on my walk like a stone, staring at my house, was a woman. I assume that she was staring. I did not know for certain. Her face was lost in the shadows. She had long hair. That much I could see in the silhouette, and she wore a long coat. Her hands were jammed into her pockets. She just stood there. I was not sure what to make of it. We were in the news, of course. Reporters stopped by at all hours. I looked up and down the street. No cars, no news vans, nothing. She had come on foot. Again, that was not unusual. I live in a suburban neighborhood. People take walks all the time, usually with a dog or spouse or both. But it was hardly earth-shattering for a woman to be walking alone. Then why had she stopped? Morbid curiosity, I figured. She looked tall from here, but that was pretty much a guess. I wondered what to do. An uneasy feeling slithered up my back. I grabbed my sweatshirt and threw it over my pajama top. Ditto with a pair of sweatpants and the bottoms. I looked out the window again. The woman stiffened. She had seen me. The woman turned and began to hurry away. My chest felt tight. I tried to open the window. It was stuck. I hit the sides to loosen it and tried again. It grudgingly gave me an inch. I lowered my mouth to the opening. Wait! She picked up the pace. Please, hold up a second. She broke into a run. Damn! I turned away and sprinted after her. I had no idea where my slippers were, and there was no time for shoes. I ran outside. The grass tickled my feet. I sprinted in the direction she had gone. I tried to follow, but I lost her. When I got back inside my house, I called Regan and told him what had happened. It sounded stupid even as I said it. A woman had been standing in front of my house. Big deal. Regan, too, sounded thoroughly unimpressed. I convinced myself that it was nothing, just a nosy neighbor. I climbed back into bed, flipped the television, and eventually I closed my eyes. The night, however, was not over. It was 4 in the morning when my phone rang. I was in the state I now refer to as sleep. I never fall into true slumber anymore. I hang above it with my eyes shut. The nights struggle by like the days. The separation between the two is the flimsiest of curtains. At night my body manages to rest, but my mind refuses to shut down. With my eyes closed, I was replaying the morning of the attack for the umpteenth time, hoping to stir a new memory. I started where I am now, in the bedroom. I remembered my alarm clock going off. Lenny and I were going to play racquetball that morning. We'd started playing every Wednesday about a year before, and so far we had progressed to the point where our games had improved from pitiful to almost remedial. Monica was awake and in the shower. I was scheduled for surgery at 11 a.m. I got up and looked in on Tara. I headed back to the bedroom. Monica was out of the shower now and putting on her jeans. I went down to the kitchen, still in my pajamas, opened the cabinet to the right of the Westinghouse refrigerator, chose the raspberry granola bar over the blueberry. I had actually told this detail to Regan recently as if it might be relevant, and bent over the sink while I ate. Bam. That was it. Nothing until the hospital. The phone rang a second time. My eyes opened. My hand found the phone. I picked it up and said, "Hello?" "It's Detective Regan. I'm with Agent Tickner. We'll be over in 2 minutes." I swallowed. "What is it?" "2 minutes." He hung up. I got out of bed. I glanced out the window, half expecting to see that woman again. No one was there. My jeans from yesterday were crumpled on the floor. I slid them on. I pulled a sweatshirt over my head and made my way down the stairs. I opened the front door and peered out. A police car turned the corner. Regan was driving. Tickner was in the passenger seat. I don't think that I had ever seen them arrive in the same vehicle. This, I knew, would not be good news. The two men stepped out of the car. Nausea swept over me. I had prepared myself for this visit since the ransom had gone wrong. I'd even gone so far as to rehearse in my mind how it would all happen, how they would deliver the hammer blow, and how I would nod and thank them and excuse myself. I practiced my reaction. I knew precisely how it would all go down. But now, as I watched Regan and Tickner head toward me, those defenses fled. Panic set in. My body began to shiver. I could barely stand. My knees wobbled and I leaned against the doorframe. The two men moved in step. I was reminded of an old war movie, the scene where the officers come to the mother's house with solemn faces. I shook my head, wishing them away. When they reached the door, the two men pushed inside. "We have something to show you," Regan said. I turned and followed. Regan flicked on a lamp, but it didn't provide much light. Tickner moved to the couch. He opened his laptop computer. The monitor sprang to life, bathing him in an LCD blue. "We had a break," Regan explained. I moved closer. "Your father-in-law gave us a list of the serial numbers on the ransom bills, remember?"
"Yes."
"One of those bills was used at a bank yesterday afternoon. Agent Tickner is bringing up a video feed right now."
"From the bank?"
I asked. "Yes. We downloaded the video onto his laptop. 12 hours ago, someone brought a $100 bill to this bank in order to get smaller notes. We want you to take a look at the video." I sat next to Tickner. He pressed a button. The video started up immediately. I expected black and white or poor, grainy quality. This feed had neither. The angle was shot from above in almost too brilliant color. A bald man was talking to a teller. There was no sound.
"I don't recognize him," I said.
"Wait." The bald man said something to the teller. They appeared to be sharing a good-natured chuckle. He picked up a slip of paper and waved goodbye. The teller gave a small wave back. The next person in line approached the booth. I heard myself groan. It was my sister, Stacy. The numb I had longed for suddenly flooded me. I don't know why. Perhaps because two polar emotions pulled at me simultaneously. One, dread. My own sister had done this. My own sister, whom I loved dearly, had betrayed me. But two, hope. We now had hope. We had a lead. And if it was Stacy, I could not believe that she would harm Tara. "Is that your sister?" Regan asked, pointing his finger at her image.
"Yes."
I looked at him. "Where was this taken?"
"The Catskills," he said. "A town called Montague," I finished for him.
Tickner and Regan looked at each other.
"How do you know that?"
But I was already heading for the door. "I know where she is." Chapter 7. My grandfather had loved to hunt. I always found this strange because he was such a gentle, soft-spoken soul. He never talked about his passion. He didn't hang deer heads over the fireplace mantel. He did not keep trophy pictures or souvenir antlers or whatever else hunters like to do with carcasses. He did not hunt with friends or family members. Hunting was a solitary activity for my grandfather. He did not explain, defend, or share it with others. In 1956, Grandpa purchased a small cabin in the hunting woods of Montague, New York. The cost, or so I am told, was under $3,000. I doubt that it would fetch much more today. There was only one bedroom.
The structure managed to be rustic without any of the charm associated with that term. It was almost impossible to find. The dirt road stopped 200 yards before the cabin. He had to hike along a root-infested trail the rest of the way. When he died 4 years ago, my grandmother inherited it. At least, that is what I assumed. No one really thought about it much. My grandparents had retired to Florida almost a decade before. My grandmother was in the murky throes of Alzheimer's now. The old cabin, I guessed, was part of her estate. In terms of taxes and whatever expenses, it was probably deep in arrears. When we were children, my sister and I spent one weekend each summer with our grandparents at the cabin. I did not like it. Nature to me was boredom, occasionally broken up by an onslaught of mosquito bites. There was no TV. We went to bed too early and in too much darkness. During the day, the deep silence was too often shattered by the charming echo of shotgun blasts. We spent most of our time taking walks, an activity I find tedious to this very day. One year, my mother only packed me khaki-colored clothes. I spent 2 days terrified that a hunter would mistake me for a deer. Stacy, on the other hand, found solace out there. Even as a young child, she seemed to revel in the escape from our suburban rat maze of school and extracurricular activities, of sport teams and popularity. She would wander for hours. She would pick leaves off the trees and collect inchworms in a jar. She would shuffle her feet across carpets of fallen pine needles. I explained about the cabin to Tickner and Regan as we sped up Route 87. Tickner radioed the police department in Montague. I still remembered how to find the cabin, but describing it was harder. I did my best. Regan kept his foot on the gas pedal. It was 4:30 in the morning. There was no traffic and no need for the siren. We reached exit 16 on the New York Thruway and sped past the Woodbury Common Outlet Center. The woods were a blur. We were not far now. I told them where to turn off. The car wound up and down back roads that had not changed one iota in the past 3 decades. 15 minutes later, we were there. Stacy. My sister had never been very attractive. That may have been part of her problem. Yes, that sounds like nonsense. It is silly, really. But I lay it out for you anyway. No one asked Stacy to any prom. Boys never called. She had very few friends. Of course, there are many adolescents with such hardships. Adolescence is always a war. No one gets out unscathed. And yes, my father's illness was a tremendous burden on us. But that doesn't explain it. In the end, after all the theories and psychoanalyzing, after all the combing through her childhood traumas, I think what went wrong with my sister was more basic. She had some kind of chemical imbalance in her brain. Too much of one compound flowing here, not enough of another flowing there. We did not recognize the warning signs soon enough. Stacy was depressed in an era when such behavior was mistaken for sullen. Or maybe, yet again, I use this sort of convoluted rationale to justify my own indifference to her. Stacy was just my weird younger sister. I had my own problems, thank you very much. I had the selfishness of a teenager, a truly redundant description if ever I've heard one. Either way, be the origins of my sister's unhappiness physiological, psychological, or the deluxe combo plan, Stacy's destructive journey was over. My little sister was dead. We found her on the floor, curled up in a tight fetal position. That was how she had slept when she was a child, her knees up to her chest, her chin tucked. But even though there was not a mark on her, I could see that she was not sleeping. I bent down. Stacy's eyes were open, She stared straight at me, unblinking, questioning. She still looked so very lost. That wasn't supposed to be. Death was supposed to bring solitude. Death was supposed to bring the peace she had found so elusive in life. Why, I wondered, did Stacy still look so damn lost? A hypodermic needle lay on the floor by her side, her companion in death as in life. Drugs, of course. Intentional or otherwise, I did not yet know. I had no time to dwell on it either. The police fanned out. I wrested my eyes away from her. Tara. The place was a mess. Raccoons had found their way in and made a little home for themselves. The couch where my grandfather had taken his naps, always with his arms folded, was torn up. The stuffing had bled onto the floor. Springs popped up looking for someone to stab. The entire place smelled like urine and dead animals. I stopped and listened for the sound of a crying baby. There was none. Nothing in here. Only one other room. I dived into the bedroom behind a policeman. The room was dark. I hit the light switch. Nothing happened. Flashlights sliced through the black like saber swords. My eyes scanned the room. When I saw it, I nearly cried out. There was a playpen. It was one of those modern pack-and-plays with the mesh sides that fold up for easy transport. Monica and I have one. I don't know anyone with a baby who doesn't. The product tag dangled off the side. It had to be new. Tears came to my eyes. The flashlight cut past the pack-and-play, giving it a strobe light effect. It appeared to be empty. My heart sank. I ran over anyway in case the light had caused an optical illusion, in case Tara was nestled so sweetly that she, I don't know, barely made a bump. But there was only a blanket inside. A soft voice. A voice from a whispery, inescapable nightmare floated across the room. Oh, Christ. I swiveled my head toward the sound. The voice came again, weaker this time. In here, a policeman said. In the closet. Tickner and Regan were already there. They both looked inside. Even in the dim glow, I saw their faces lose color. My feet stumbled forward. I crossed the room, nearly falling, grabbing the closet doorknob at the last moment to regain my balance. I looked through the doorway and saw it. And then as I looked down at the frayed fabric, I could actually feel my insides implode and crumble into ash. There, lying on the floor, torn and discarded, was a pink one-piece outfit with black penguins. 18 months later, Lydia saw the widow sitting alone at Starbucks. The widow was on a stool seat, gazing absently at the gentle trickle of pedestrians. Her coffee was near the window, the steam forming a circle on the glass. Lydia watched her for a moment. The devastation was still there. The battle-scarred, thousand-yard stare, the posture of the defeated, the hair with no sheen, the shake in the hands. Lydia ordered a grande skim latte with an extra shot of espresso. The barista, a too skinny black-clad youth with a goatee, gave her the shot on the house. Men, even ones this young, did stuff like that for Lydia. She lowered her sunglasses and thanked him. He nearly wet himself. Men. Lydia moved toward the condiment table, knowing he was checking out her ass. Again, she was used to it. She added a packet of Equal to her drink. The Starbucks was fairly empty. There were plenty of seats, but Lydia slid up on the stool immediately next to the widow. Sensing her, the widow startled out of her reverie. "Wendy," Lydia said. Wendy Burnett, the widow, turned toward the soft voice. "I'm very sorry for your loss," Lydia said. Lydia smiled at her. She had, she knew, a warm smile. She wore a tailored gray suit on her petite, tight frame. The skirt was slit fairly high. Business sexy. Her eyes had that shiny, wet thing going, her nose small and slightly upturned. Her hair was auburn ringlets, but she could, and often did, change that. Wendy Burnett stared just long enough for Lydia to wonder if she'd been recognized. Lydia had seen that stare plenty of times before, that unsure, "I know you from somewhere" expression, even though she had not been on TV since she'd turned 13. Some people would even comment, "Hey, you know who you look like?" But Lydia, she had been billed as Larissa Dane back then, would shrug it away. But alas, this hesitation was not like that. Wendy Burnett was still shell-shocked from the horrible death of her beloved. It simply took her a while to register and assimilate unfamiliar data. She was probably wondering how to react, if she should pretend she knew Lydia or not. After another few seconds, Wendy Burnett went for the non-committal. "Thank you." "Poor Jimmy," Lydia followed up. "Such an awful way to go." Wendy fumbled for the paper coffee cup and downed a healthy sip. Lydia checked out the little boxes on the side of the cup and saw that the widow Wendy had ordered a grande latte too, though she'd chosen half decaf and soy milk. Lydia slid a little closer to her. "You don't know who I am, do you?" Wendy gave her a weak, got-me smile. "I'm sorry. No need to be. I don't think we ever met." Wendy waited for Lydia to introduce herself. When she didn't, Wendy said, "You knew my husband then?" "Oh, yes." "Are you in the insurance business, too?" "No, I'm afraid not." Wendy frowned. Lydia sipped her beverage. The awkwardness grew, at least for Wendy. Lydia was fine with it. When it became too much, Wendy rose to leave. "Well," she said, "it was nice meeting you." Lydia began, hesitating until she was sure that she had Wendy's full attention. "I was the last person to see Jimmy alive." Wendy froze. Lydia took another sip and closed her eyes. "Nice and strong," she said, gesturing toward the cup. "I love the coffee here, don't you?" "Did you say?" "Please," Lydia said with a small sweep of her arm. "Have a seat, so I can explain properly." Wendy glanced over at the baristas. They were busy gesticulating and whining about what they thought was the great world conspiracy that kept them from the most amazing of lives. Wendy slid back onto the stool. For a few moments, Lydia just stared at her. Wendy tried to hold her gaze. "You see," Lydia began, offering up a fresh, warm smile and tilting her head to the side, "I'm the one who killed your husband." Wendy's face went pale. "That isn't funny." "True. Yes, I'd have to agree with you on that, Wendy. But then again, humor was not really my aim. Would you like to hear a joke instead? I'm on one of those joke email lists. Most are duds, but every once in a while they send a howler." Wendy sat stunned. "Who the hell are you?" "Calm down a second, Wendy. I want to know..." "Shh." Lydia put her finger to Wendy's lip with too much tenderness. "Let me explain, okay?" Wendy's lips trembled. Lydia kept her finger there for a few more seconds.
You're confused. I understand that. Let me clarify a few things for you. First off, yes, I'm the one who put the bullet in Jimmy's head. But Heshy...
Lydia pointed out the window in the direction of an enormous man with a misshapen head.
He did the earlier damage.
Personally, by the time I shot Jimmy, well, I think I might have been doing him a favor.
Wendy just stared.
You want to know why, am I right?
Of course you do.
But deep down inside, Wendy, I think you know.
We're women of the world, aren't we? We know our men.
Wendy said nothing.
Wendy, do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Sure you do, but I'll say it anyway. Jimmy, your dearly departed husband, owed a great deal of money to some very unpleasant people. As of today, the amount is just under $200,000.
Lydia smiled.
Wendy, you're not going to pretend you know nothing about your husband's gambling woes, are you?
Wendy had trouble forming the words in her mouth.
I don't understand.
I hope your confusion has nothing to do with my gender.
What?
That would be really narrow and sexist on your part, don't you think? This is the 21st century. Women can be whatever they want.
You...
Wendy stopped, tried again.
You murdered my husband.
Do you watch much television, Wendy?
What?
Television. You see, on television, whenever someone like your husband owes money to someone like me,
well, what happens?
Lydia stopped as if she really expected her to answer. Wendy finally said,
I don't know.
Sure you do, but again, I'll answer for you.
The someone like me...
Okay. Usually the male, someone like me, is sent to threaten him. Then maybe my cohort Heshy out there would beat him up or break his legs, something like that. But they never kill the guy. That's one of those TV bad guy rules. You can't collect from a dead man. You've heard that, haven't you, Wendy?
She waited.
Wendy finally said,
I guess. But see, that's wrong.
Let's take Jimmy, for example. Your husband had a disease.
Gambling.
Am I right? It cost you everything, didn't it? The insurance business. That had been your father's. Jimmy took it over for him. It's gone now. Wiped out. The bank was ready to foreclose on your house. You and the kids barely had enough money for groceries. And still, Jimmy didn't stop.
Lydia shook her head. Men.
Am I right? There were tears in Wendy's eyes. Her voice, when she was able to speak, was so weak.
So you killed him?
Lydia looked up, shaking her head gently.
I'm really not explaining this well, am I?
She lowered her gaze and tried again.
Have you ever heard the expression that you can't squeeze blood from a stone?
Again, Lydia waited for an answer. Wendy finally nodded. Lydia seemed pleased.
Well, that's the case here. With Jimmy, I mean. I could have Heshy out there work him over.
Heshy is good at that.
But what good would that do?
Jimmy didn't have the money. He would never be able to get his hands on that kind of cash.
Lydia sat a little straighter and put out her hands. Now, Wendy, I want you to think like a businessman.
Check that.
A business person.
We don't have to be raving feminists, but I think we should at least keep ourselves on equal footing. Lydia gave Wendy another smile.
Wendy cringed.
Okay, so what am I, as a wise business person, what am I supposed to do? I can't let the debt go unpaid, of course. In my line of work, that's professional suicide. Someone owes my employer money, they have to pay. No way around that. The problem here is Jimmy doesn't have a cent to his name, but...
Lydia stopped and widened her smile.
But he does have a wife and three kids. And he used to be in the insurance business. Do you see where I'm going with this, Wendy?
Wendy was afraid to breathe.
Oh, I think you do. But again, I'll say it for you. Insurance. More specifically, life insurance. Jimmy had a policy. He didn't admit it right away, but eventually. Well, Heshy can be persuasive.
Wendy's eyes drifted toward the window. Lydia saw the shiver and hid a smile.
Jimmy told us he had two policies, in fact, with a total payout of nearly $1 million.
So you... Wendy was struggling to comprehend.
You killed Jimmy for the insurance money?
Lydia snapped her fingers.
You go, girlfriend.
Wendy opened her mouth, but nothing came out.
And Wendy, let me make this crystal clear. Jimmy's debts don't die with him. We both know that. The bank still wants you to pay the mortgage, am I right? The credit card companies don't stop mounting the interest.
Lydia shrugged her small shoulders, palms to the sky.
Why should my employer be any different?
You can't be serious.
Your first insurance check should come in about a week. By that time, your husband's debt will be $280,000. I'll expect a check for that amount on that day.
But the bills he left alone.
Again, Lydia silenced her with a finger to her lips. Her voice dropped to an intimate whisper.
That doesn't really concern me, Wendy. I have given you the rare opportunity to get out from under.
Declare bankruptcy if you must. You live in a ritzy area. Move out.
Have Jack. That's your 11-year-old, correct?
Wendy jolted at the sound of her son's name.
Well, no summer camp for Jack this year. Have him get a job after school. Whatever. None of that concerns me.
You, Wendy, will pay what you owe, and that will be the end of this. You will never see or hear from me again. If you don't pay, however...
Well... Take a good look at Heshy over there.
She paused, letting Wendy do just that. It had the desired effect.
We'll kill little Jack first. Then 2 days later, we'll kill Lila.
If you report this conversation to the police, we'll kill Jack and Lila and Darlene. All three, in age order. And then after, you bury your children.
Please listen, Wendy, because this is key. I'll still make you pay.
Wendy couldn't speak. Lydia followed up a deep, caffeinated sip with an ah of satisfaction.
Delightful, she said, rising from her seat.
I really enjoyed our little girl chat, Wendy. We should get together again soon. Say, your house at noon on Friday the 16th.
Wendy kept her head down.
Do you understand?
Yes.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to pay the debt, Wendy said.
Lydia smiled at her.
Again, my sincerest condolences. Lydia headed outside and breathed in the fresh air. She looked behind her. Wendy Burnett had not moved. Lydia waved goodbye and met up with Heshy. He was nearly 6'6". She was 5'1". He weighed 275 pounds. She was 105. He had a head like a misshapen pumpkin. Her features seemed to have been made in the Orient, out of porcelain. "Problems?" Heshy asked. "Please," she said with a dismissive wave. "On to more profitable ventures." "Did you find our man?"
"Yes."
"And the package is already out?"
"Sure, Lydia."
"Very good."
She frowned, felt a gnawing.
"What's wrong?" he asked.
"I have a funny feeling, that's all."
"You want to back out?"
Lydia smiled at him.
"Not on your life, Pooh Bear."
"Then what do you want to do?"
She thought about it.
"Let's just see how Dr. Seidman reacts."
Chapter 8. "Don't drink any more apple juice," Cheryl told her 2-year-old Connor. I stood on the sidelines with my arms folded. It was a bit nippy, the frosty, damp chill of late New Jersey autumn, so I pulled the hood of my sweatshirt over my Yankee cap. I also had on a pair of Ray-Bans, sunglasses and hood. I looked very much like the police sketch of the Unabomber. We were at a soccer game for 8-year-old boys. Lenny was the head coach. He needed an assistant and recruited me because I assume I am the only one who knows even less about soccer than he does. Still, our team was winning. I think the score was about 83-2, but I'm not certain.
"Why can't I have more juice?" Connor asked.
"Because," Cheryl answered with the patience of a mother, "apple juice gives you diarrhea."
"It does?"
"Yes." To my right, Lenny drowned the kids in a steady stream of encouragement. "You're the best, Ricky. Way to go, Petey. Now that's what I call hustle, Davy." He always added a Y to the end of their names. And yes, it is annoying. Once, in a pitch of overexcitement, he called me Marky. Once.
"Uncle Mark?"
I felt a tug at my leg. I looked down at Connor, who was 26 months old.
"What's up, pal?"
"Apple juice gives me a diarrhea."
"Good to know," I said.
"Uncle Mark?"
"Yeah?" Connor gave me his gravest look.
"Diarrhea," he said, "is not my friend."
I glanced at Cheryl. She smothered a smile, but I saw the concern there, too. I looked back at Connor. "Words to live by, kid." Connor nodded, pleased by my response. I love him. He breaks my heart and brings me joy in equal measure and at exactly the same time. 26 months old. 2 months older than Tara. I watch his development with awe and a longing that could heat a furnace. He turned back to his mother. Littered about Cheryl was the product of her mommy as pack mule harvest. There were Minute Maid juice boxes and Nutri-Grain bars. There were Pampers baby dry diapers, as opposed to baby wet, and Huggies wipes containing aloe vera for the discriminating buttock. There were angled baby bottles from Evenflow. There were cinnamon Teddy Grahams and well-scrubbed baby carrots and sectioned orange and cut-up grapes, sliced the long way so as to make them choke-proof, and cubes of what I hoped was cheese, all hermetically sealed in their own Ziploc bag. Lenny, the head coach, was yelling out key game-winning strategy to our players. When we are on offense, he tells them to score. When we are on defense, he advises them to stop him. And then sometimes, like right now, He offered keen insight into the subtleties of the game. Kick the ball! Lenny glanced at me after he'd shouted that for the fourth time in a row. I gave him a thumbs up and way-to-go nod. He wanted to give me the finger, but there were too many underage witnesses. I refolded my arms and squinted at the field. The kids were geared up like the pros. They wore cleats. Their socks were pulled up over their shin guards. Most wore that black grease under their eyes, even though there was nary a hint of sunshine. Two even had those breathing strip bandages across their noses. I watched Kevin, my godson, try, per his father's instructions, to kick the ball. And then it hit me like a body blow. I staggered back. That was how it always happened. I'll be watching the game, or I'll be having dinner with friends, or I'll be working on a patient, or listening to a song on the radio. I'll be doing something normal, average, feeling pretty decent, and then, wham, I get blindsided. My eyes welled up. That never used to happen to me before the murder and kidnapping. I am a doctor. I know how to play poised in both my professional and personal life. But now I wear sunglasses all the time, like some self-important B-movie star. Cheryl looked up at me, and again I saw the concern. I straightened and forced a smile. Cheryl was becoming beautiful. That happens sometimes. Motherhood agreed with certain women. It gave their physical appearance a wonder and richness that borders on the celestial. I don't want to give you the wrong impression. I don't spend every day crying. I still live my life. I am bereaved, sure, but not all the time. I am not paralyzed. I work, though I haven't yet had the courage to travel overseas. I keep thinking that I need to stay close by, in case there's a new development. That kind of thinking is, I know, not rational and perhaps even delusional. But I'm still not ready. What gets me, what gives me that surprise wham, is the way grief seems to relish in catching you unawares. Grief, when spotted, can be, if not handled, somewhat manipulated, finessed, concealed. But grief likes to hide behind bushes. It enjoys leaping out of nowhere, startling you, mocking you, stripping away your pretense of normalcy. Grief lulls you to sleep, thus making that blindside hit all the more jarring. Uncle Mark? It was Connor again. He talked pretty well for a kid his age. I wondered what Tara's voice would have sounded like, and behind my sunglasses, my eyes closed. Sensing something, Cheryl reached out to pull him away. I shook her off. What is it, pal? What about poop? What about it? He looked up and closed one eye in concentration. Is poop my friend? Hell of a question. I don't know, pal. What do you think? Connor considered his own queries so hard it appeared as if he might explode. Finally, he replied, "It's more my friend than diarrhea." I nodded sagely. Our team scored another goal. Lenny shot his fists into the air and shouted, "Yes!" He nearly cartwheeled out to congratulate Craig, or should I say Craigie, the goal scorer. The players followed him. There was much high-fiving. I don't join in. My job, I figured, was to be the quiet partner to Lenny's histrionics, the Tonto to his Lone Ranger, the Abbott to his Costello, the Rowan to his Martin, the Captain to his Tennille. Balance. I watched the parents on the sidelines. The mothers become clusters. They talk about their kids, about their child's achievements and extracurricular activities, and no one listens much because other people's children are boring. The fathers offered more variety. Some videotaped. Some yelled encouragement. Some rode their kids in a way that borders on the